Hello, Sean. Hello, Laurel.
Hello, John K. Wilson.
Hey, John.
So you know what I realized? It has been more than a month since the three of us have been together in the same room to record a podcast.
You know, I noticed that too, but only with the help of a calendar, because in the age of COVID, time is meaningless.
Yeah, I mean, I've been making X's on my wall to count the days, but I think I maybe did two X's yesterday, so it's all up in the air at this point.
We're all trying to figure it out, you know? I gotta say, I'm kind of getting used to it, though, you know? Instead of seeing Sean in his normal business casual attire, I'm seeing him in his Adidas tracksuit sweatshirt. And Laurel's husband and dogs rustling around in the background, they're kind of just par for the course now. It's got me thinking, like, is this the new normal?
Yeah, I kind of know what you're saying, John. And, you know, you just look at the news this week. We covered our first COVID election, and we had to wait almost a week for the results, which was strange at first, but we did it.
Yeah, and kind of in the same vein, we had our first virtual session, the Assembly on Tuesday, the Senate on Wednesday. And at first, the virtual roll calls and kind of how it all played out was pretty weird and surreal. But by the end of Wednesday, it was like, well, this is our life now.
And, you know, you think about the governor's administration this week issued another stay-at-home order for an additional month, which is a huge deal. And yet, I gotta say, it was not totally unexpected.
Well, this is where I would normally say, let's talk about it. This is the WPR Politics Podcast. I'm John K. Wilson.
I'm Sean Johnson.
And I'm Laurel White.
This week on the podcast, is this the new normal? All right, y'all, we have a lot to talk about this week. So do we want to just get into it?
Let's do it.
I guess in chronological order, do we want to start with the election? Because that happened all the way ago on Monday.
Or did yeah. It happened all the way ago, 2 weeks ago almost now. Yeah. Yeah, let's talk about that.
The election results, I guess. The weird span of election time.
I feel like before we talk about the actual results, the fact that they came on Monday just has thrown off my week so much, because I'm so used to getting results on Tuesday night that, like,
I know.
It made it Tuesday in my heart and mind. And so then when Tuesday happened, I was like, wait, it was like Groundhog Day. It was very weird.
Yeah, plus we have ended up working on the weekends a lot throughout this. And so I'm lost. I'm lost.
Yeah.
I know this is Friday because my calendar says it's Friday, but it just feels like day to me.
I should point out, when Sean said calendar, he was pointing at his watch.
It's a fancy watch.
Nouns are losing meaning, you know, for him now.
The time things.
Okay, so let's talk about the election.
Yeah. We're going to have a new state Supreme Court justice in Wisconsin, which is kind of a big deal. There are only 7 of them. They hold 10-year terms. And so while the whole world coming apart at the seams is pretty big news in Wisconsin political news, this is pretty interesting. Jill Karofsky defeated Justice Daniel Kelly. Kelly's the first incumbent to lose since 2008 when that was Justice Louis Butler. Before then, it had been 1967, I believe, since an incumbent lost. So kind of a big deal. What got me was that it was a lopsided election. And I have to admit, I was not expecting a lopsided election for the Democrats in this race, just given that, well, first of all, we didn't know what this election was going to be like in terms of turnout or any of it. You know? And
yeah.
So that's not where I was headed into this.
Well, we saw all of the kind of pushback from Democrats before the election and even after Election Day, talking about how, you know, voters had been disenfranchised, and kind of all the signals were pointing to Democrats thinking that their turnout in particular was going to be hurt by the election moving forward the way that it did. So it was kind of a shock to see that actually Karofsky's folks turned out pretty well for her. I mean, actually turnout for a state Supreme Court race was really strong when you put it in context with other state Supreme Court races over the years, right?
And I guess we're sort of obliged to mention here that this isn't officially a nonpartisan race, but Kurofsky is the candidate who was supported by Democrats, and Daniel Kelly was the candidate who was supported by Republicans.
Right.
Right.
And it, if you look at turnout, it was around 34% turnout. It, in terms of that percentage, it matched the 2011 Supreme Court race, which was... This was the first race that happened after Walker introduced Act 10, and the state was kind of mad as hell, and that was the race that was the outlet for it. It fell short of 2016 turnout, but 2016 we had competitive presidential primaries for Republicans and Democrats. So this time around, this was another one of the unknowns for us. We knew this was, at least technically, we had a Democratic primary for president, and that Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders were still in this race. But it just felt like, because we hadn't seen them at all in the last month, didn't feel like they were really campaigning here. I was not expecting turnout to be high for that race. But it turns out that people still wanted to vote for Bernie or Biden, or in some cases, other people in the race for president. There were more votes cast in the Democratic primary for president than Jill Kurofsky received in her Supreme Court race, despite her lopsided win. So I think you look at that, you got to think that was a factor in driving up turnout for her.
Yeah.
And we should mention Joe Biden was the winner of that Democratic primary in Wisconsin. I mean, the race for the Democratic nomination had gotten much less competitive by the time it rolled around to Wisconsin's primary. Biden was heavily favored in polling going into it ahead of Bernie Sanders, and everybody else had dropped out as of that point. But yeah, Joe Biden did win by a healthy margin there.
And then Bernie dropped out. Sorry, why don't you go ahead,
Lowell? That's exactly what I was going to say. Because, yeah, Bernie dropped out the day after, which is an interesting thing to mention because, you know, him staying in the race, at, you know, officially through the primary could have helped spur some of that turnout, like Sean said, you know, people wanting to go to the polls and cast their ballot for Bernie and make that political statement and, you know, kind of weigh in on the way that they want the party to go.
Because he has, obviously, hardcore supporters, Bernie Sanders does. Yeah. And they may not just want to go out and vote for any old candidate, but they'll vote for Bernie, and that could have trickled down to Jill Kurofsky. But I will say, presidential primary aside, it was quite a race for her, quite an election for her. You know, she really had great numbers everywhere, basically. I mean, if you look at the Democratic strongholds, we all know that Dean County votes for Democrats. It's not like rocky science here, but wow, her margins there were even bigger than we've seen in the past, like 81%. She cut into the usual Republican edge in places like Waukesha, Ozaukee, Washington, which we have called for a while now the WOW counties. Apparently now we have to talk about the Bow counties.
I am so into this. I'm so into it. Bow, wow, wow, yippee-o.
Keep going, Laurel. Good.
I'm done. That's good.
Yeah, nope. Got to finish it strong.
The Bow counties are Brown, Outagamie, Winnebago. And these are more swingy counties. So these are counties that were won by Scott Walker. These are counties that were won by Donald Trump. But these are counties that are won by Jill Kurofsky in her race. And so I did think you saw in this race, more than any race we've seen before, the Democratic Party just going all in on calling her their candidate. They spent $1.3 million at least on her behalf. It's more than a state party's ever spent before. The Republican Party has been in... The Republican Party has gotten behind judicial candidates in a big way in the past. This is the biggest the Democrats have ever done. And so they were making sure that Democratic primary voters who went out there knew who to vote for in that judicial race, it looks like. And as far as we can tell, it worked.
The other thing that was interesting to me, and I'm not really sure what to make of it, but was that Kelly underperformed Brian Hagedorn in the Supreme Court election that was held last year. In Brian Hagedorn won, that he was the conservative, and he won in a really, really close race. And Daniel Kelly just did not match the margins that Hagedorn won in those solidly conservative areas.
Yeah, and when Hagedorn only won his election by less than 6,000 votes, there's just no like margin for error. If you're going to follow the Hagedorn model for victory, and you know, you, a conservative candidate, are not keeping up with him in conservative strongholds, you're going to be in trouble unless there's a big drop off in votes in Democratic counties. And I thought it was possible that you would see a drop off in Democratic votes. I mean, you know, we did see the lines in Milwaukee of very dedicated voters who stood there for hours, sometimes in the rain, to vote. But I mean, it crossed my mind that you've only got five polling places and it takes forever to vote. That's going to drive down turnout. Apparently not in, I mean, or maybe it did, but not in enough, not in a way that it cut into Karofsky's support in a way that hurt her.
So that's sort of the new normal in terms of elections in Wisconsin in COVID time. You know, we had these crazy elections and all this back and forth, and then we got the results and we know where we're going moving forward. How about the seemingly new normal in the state legislature?
Yeah, so that was really interesting this week. We had our first virtual sessions in the Assembly and the Senate. I think it would be really easy for us to sort of just talk about the process and what that looked like and how it was for reporters and lawmakers. And I could easily eat up the entire podcast doing that. We won't do that.
You make it sound so interesting.
It was so crazy. We've had so many moments over the past several weeks that feel like you're really living history, and obviously we are. But witnessing the first time that lawmakers have voted in this way, it felt like not real life. And there were moments that were kind of funny. It seems wrong to say that, because obviously this is really important and very serious legislation. But you try to look for moments of levity or whatever in this really difficult time. And I think one of those was getting a little bit of insight into like lawmakers as real people, seeing their houses and, you know, their home offices and their kitchens. And
so
we're not going to go into that. Yeah.
We were sufficiently fascinated by that we're going to have a little roundup of what we saw in the virtual session at the end of this podcast.
Yeah. We're going to push
first,
it to the
very
end.
Serious policy stuff, which we are obligated to cover as Capitol reporters.
We'll have our salad and then we can have our dessert later.
No, whatever. I only eat desserts now. A salad sounds great, but very high effort. No greens in my house at the moment.
Well, okay. Let's talk about the salad. Let's talk about the legislation and the debate about it. We've talked pretty extensively about what this COVID-19 bill had in it. I think just like a quick summary, one of the really big proposals was lifting that 1 week waiting period for unemployment insurance. That's something that the governor and leaders have been talking about for a long time. It's retroactive, so it goes back for unemployment claims filed in March, and it goes all the way until next February. So people don't have that lag time. They can start getting benefits more quickly. There are also a number of provisions in the new law, because the governor signed it quickly after it was passed, that have to do with insurance. So insurers are required to cover COVID-19 testing. They're not allowed to charge people more for out-of-network care if someone has to go out of their network because their in-network provider is, you know, at capacity, for example. Expanding vaccines in the senior care, you know, coverage of vaccines in the state senior care program. saying that insurers can't discriminate against people who have had or may have had COVID-19. And just a really broad, I mean, this is, we say it kind of a lot, but this is a really broad proposal that touched on a lot of different things.
In your story about it, I had to think of some different words I think you used sweeping several times.
I did.
So I had to change one to broad. I think I changed one to like far reaching or something.
Yes, you swept away some of my sweepings, which I really appreciate.
Yeah, you know.
But I would say, by and large, not as sweeping as the governor had been hoping for. You know, it's not, right. It's not, it doesn't extend his emergency powers. It doesn't give his administration what's called some sufficient funding to deal with COVID-19, where they can kind of spend what they need. It doesn't have some of the money that he wanted for, you know, I think small businesses. And, mm-hmm. you know, that was sort of a budgetary conflict, really. I mean, first of all, the legislature doesn't want to give him unlimited authority to deal with this stuff. And second of all, they say, we just don't have the money to do this, that our budget's going to be in shambles already. And then if you, you know, dedicate this funding for new projects, new programs, it's not going to work out. So they had that clash between them, but definitely not exactly what Evers wanted. Not what lawmakers wanted either. They did take out that provision that they had in an earlier draft where the Joint Finance Committee would have had unilateral power to cut the budget. That didn't fly with Democrats.
There is something to do with the Joint Finance Committee in the new law, though. It gives JFC the power to transfer money from different appropriations in the state budget to response to COVID-19, but puts a cap on it, a $75 million cap. So that's really the only thing that was like a sort of a spending element in the
And
proposal.
I feel like when this is all said and done, I feel like $75 million is going to look like small potatoes, you know, because I feel like the budget cuts that are going to be required by what we've seen could be pretty severe. You know, Governor Evers hinted as much in a letter to the White House where he joined other governors in saying states need more money to deal with what's happening right now. So $75 million, it's something. It's not nothing, but it's not huge.
Yeah. I mean, I think in that letter, didn't the governor say the state's going to take a roughly $2 billion revenue hit? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So buckle up.
So is this the last we've seen from the legislature at this point, or are there any plans to come back and do anything else addressing COVID?
I think that's an open question and a pretty important one. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald said that, I mean, he seemed to indicate that they might be back, that they might have to do something, but he didn't say for sure. The Senate, in its virtual setup, they had Senate President Roger Roth was in this committee room to oversee the session. And he told people after the session, don't move anything in case we need to come back. I want this setup to be the same. That is per the pool report from the Senate virtual session. So it seems like they're bracing for it, but you know, that bill passed the Senate 32-0, and just everything that Republicans and have said since then feels like that's going to be like the last bipartisan thing we have happen for a while is the way it feels. So it's an open question, but an important one.
Well, before we get to our dessert that we promised, there was one other really big piece of news that we mentioned earlier this week, and that would be the governor extending the stay-at-home order for another good month or so.
Through Memorial Day, which was kind of like a shocking timestamp for me when someone said that. I was like, wow, yeah, that's true. So now it goes through May 26th. And it looks pretty similar to the stay-at-home order that we've been living under for a while now, with just like a couple tweaks. One of them, interestingly, is the fact that golf courses are going to be allowed to open back up again. That's something we know that some lawmakers have called for, some groups have called for. for people who aren't golfers, something that will be a change is that some non-essential businesses will be allowed to go to what the administration is calling basic operations. And under those, they'll be able to do curbside pickup for customers. So places that have been closed down under the previous or the current order, once the current order expires on April 24th, they'll be able to open back up again and do curbside pickup if they want to, if they find that that's, you know, something that they're capable of doing and interested in doing. What else was interesting about the order? I mean, it specified that schools are definitely going to be closed for the rest of the year. I think that's something people kind of thought at this point, but it made it official. What am I leaving out?
Some pretty big stuff. This is pretty big stuff. The schools thing is pretty huge. You know, I have two daughters now who are doing virtual learning on a regular basis, and just the thought that they're not going to go back, like, that's it for fourth grade. That's it for kindergarten. I'm sure a lot of parents are also thinking, like, dang, wow, this is happening. That's a big, big adjustment for people to go through.
I mean, I think the other big aspect of this new stay-at-home order, aside from some of the specific changes in there, is the reaction to it.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there had been some pushback about the governor's shelter-in-place, safer-at-home order over time. And we had seen that kind of ramping up a little bit in recent days. There was a protest we know that was scheduled, that is still scheduled, as far as I know, for next week at the Capitol, calling for the governor to end it after the current, you know, order expires on April 24th. But what really happened after this new announcement was, I think, that opposition being turned up to 11, basically. I mean, like, a number of Republican lawmakers issued really strong statements saying that it wasn't appropriate that the governor was doing this, that they thought it was not right that the legislature wasn't involved to a greater extent in the decision-making process. And both Senator Fitzgerald and Speaker Voss alluded to potential legal action against the administration. So I think this is going to be something that becomes like a pretty big fight in the days and weeks to come.
Yeah, it's pretty noteworthy that on a week when they had a nearly unanimous vote in the legislature for this COVID-19 bill, I mean, there were two lawmakers that voted against it. They're both Democrats. This was the week when this bipartisan harmony, to the extent that it existed, seems like it fell apart. And, you know, you now have, it seems like a lot of Republican lawmakers saying the governor needs to have a plan for reopening the state. And then you have two Republican senators, Dave Craig and Steve Nass, saying, let's fire Andrea Palm, the DHS secretary who has signed some of the most consequential orders, including stay at home. So, feels like pretty big week in terms of the political reaction to all of this. And I don't think that protest next week is going to take things down a notch. You know, that's probably going to the combination of the election that we just went through and that protest, I think the partisanship will be pretty heated here for a while.
So that all sounds like salad to keep watching, but I was also promised dessert, guys.
Yeah. Before partisanship just overcomes all of us, I got to say that we really enjoyed the virtual sessions of the legislature and getting to look into people's homes. It was nice. And so, John, we have prepared a little slideshow for you because you didn't watch these sessions, if I'm correct.
That's right.
Okay, good. Mm-hmm. So you get to experience it real time on the podcast here. And so we've selected some screenshots of a handful of lawmakers to give you a feel for what it was like. So, John, I would like you to open up the slideshow that we've presented for you. Laurel and I put this together. All right. Are you there?
I am there.
What's the name of the slideshow?
Wisconsin Legislature Virtual Session. Turns out legislators are people after all.
Of course they're people, but we don't get to see that side of them very often. So I thought it was kind of nice to recognize that they're not just people who get dressed up and go to the chambers of the Assembly and Senate to argue with each other, that they do in fact have lives. So, John, I'd like you to go to the first slide of pictures there.
All right, hold on. All right, I'm there.
And what do you see? What do you see?
Well, we have three men. Looks like one's in his living room wearing a fleece. You can see a cat tree behind him.
Very good. That's Representative Nick Milroy.
Another gentleman is in his kitchen. It looks like there's a thank you card propped up next to him. The camera angle's a little bit off. You can see a lot of the ceiling of his kitchen.
And what's the green thing we see there?
Is that a fern?
I think it's a plant. Yes.
Overhanging
this is
the
Representative
camera.
Todd Onstad, who is a favorite of people who I saw watching the virtual session. They liked the plant. That was kind of fun.
Yeah. And then we also have a gentleman in a nice plaid blazer. Looks like in a basement on like a old plush couch. And he has a Wisconsin flag tacked up on the wall behind him.
I like that one. That's Representative Prashinsky. I love the flag. And I got to say, the blazer was a little polarizing. It, just on Twitter, some people liked it. Some people didn't like it. I like it.
I mean, it seems like, you know, like a 1970s like school principal outfit like with the blazer.
Got that nice
and
wide lapel. Yeah.
He really went for the like blending patterns. I've heard that this is a thing in men's fashion where you do like different patterns for the blazer and the tie. Like he's got like the plaid and the stripes and it's a contrast, but
he's dressed up, but then like, you know, there's a folding chair in the background and, you know,
yeah,
an old beat up couch. It's an interesting mix of things in that photo.
So this, the theme of this slide, John, is that lawmakers had to choose how they were going to appear before the state of Wisconsin. You know, where are we going to set this camera? Some of them set it behind a plant. Some had a backdrop of a cat playground. And then, you know, we got the Wisconsin flag backdrop there. Okay,
this
next
is the camera angle slide.
I wonder if he puts that, if the flag is up there in general as a decoration or if that was like put up there for the session.
Somebody noted on Twitter that the flag looks as it, you can still see the creases from where it was folded, possibly in the package. So I don't know. To me, it doesn't matter if it was new or old. I dig it. Next slide.
This is such a great one. This might be my favorite.
Oh, this one I actually saw a picture of on Twitter. This is the there's a little bit of Green Bay Packers decoration going on in the background of this bedroom.
Is this State Senator Dave Hansen?
I don't know if this is a guest bedroom or his personal bedroom, but the curtains are Packers, the pillows are Packers. There's a whole bunch of stuff hanging on the wall that's Packers. There's a theme to the room, definitely.
And he represents Green Bay, too. So that's State Senator Dave Hansen showing his Green Bay colors there. I saw somebody point out on Twitter, I'm sorry, I can't quite attribute here, but, you know, would it surprise you to know that this person is from Green Bay? And someone else noted, yeah, but this person could be anywhere in the state of Wisconsin, honestly. Like, the Green Bay Cave is not limited to the city of Green Bay. It's like a Packers fan thing, not a Green Bay City thing.
So
Dave Hansen has it, though.
I think it's important to mention here that this could be one of the last times that Dave Hansen appears as a state senator because he's retiring. He's not running for re-election.
That is true.
One of the last times that he appears in this official capacity, he could be flanked in all of this, you know, Green Bay paraphernalia. Kind of cool.
Next slide.
All right.
What do you see here?
Well, so there are two slides here with two lawmakers in the middle of the frame. And then we see a couple of faces poking in from the sides of the screen. I'm guessing trying to figure out, you know, help the lawmakers figure something out here.
I think it might. Well, so yes. I can't speak. So one is Senator Fred Risser, and the other is Representative Jimmy Boy Edbing. I don't know if Fred Risser needed a helper for his side, but I'm pretty sure Representative Edmund did, because every time that he had to vote or like take attendance, that head would pop in from the side, at least for the first few times, to unmute, I believe. So I'm laughing as somebody who's been on a call during the COVID era and tried unsuccessfully to unmute. So I'm kind of, I'm laughing out of experience, but it was fun to watch that.
It's a universal experience for all of us. And I think, you know, seeing people go through it as you have gone through it, it's bringing us all together. It's uniting. You know, I was on a Slack message with Sean when he was having his muting troubles, you know, because he gets called on
a
call.
Right?
And it's just, there's just silence. And I'm like, oh no, this is not going well.
I was trying so hard. Star six. Did I remute myself? I don't know. But I also thought this was noteworthy because Fred Risser is a World War II veteran. He was first elected to the legislature in 1956. He's the nation's longest serving legislator. And here he is serving one of his final days in the legislature by computer. You know, it's kind of surreal to think about. Yeah. Okay, next slide.
Ooh, this is nice. I'd say the uniting theme between these three photos is that they have great pine paneling.
That's right.
In their rooms.
Yes.
Very good.
Some good knotty pine.
Yeah, and this is State Senator Luther Olson, Representative Steve Doyle, and Representative Romaine Quinn. A bipartisan love of the wood paneling in Wisconsin. So I like that. We ready for the next one?
Mm-hmm. Aww.
Two commonalities here, John. Let's see if you can pick them both out.
Well, I mean, the obvious one is that the lawmakers are appearing with their kids. The other commonality, their ties are different colors. One has flags in the room, the other one doesn't. I mean, the kids are both standing on the same side as the lawmaker.
I don't know.
So it's not really you can't really see it in the picture. You kind of have to know this one. But this is, we're looking at Representative David Crowley, and that's State Senator Chris Larson, both with children in their pictures. And
they were running against each other in for the Milwaukee County Executive's race. That's who that
very
is.
Very good.
Yes.
And Representative Crowley going to be the new Milwaukee County Executive. Okay, one last slide, John, and this is the one that got all the attention this week.
Oh, yeah, I saw this one on Twitter, too. This is good. This is a nice giant zebra pelt on the wall, along with what looks like the head of some sort of hoofed animal.
I think it's a camel.
A camel?
I think so. I think it's a camel. I mean, I've looked
it's
at
got
it quite a
that
bit.
Interesting, like neck hair situation that I feel like is a camel characteristic. I think you might be right.
So we can't verify, but I feel like whatever that bust is on the wall has gotten a lot less attention because of the zebra pelt on the wall of Representative Cindy Duco.
It was just so cool. I just love it. And I love, like, this is obviously like a bold decorating choice, and like my hat is off to her because I love that. But it's also like she kind of like when we talked about with the first slide, lawmakers had to choose how they wanted to position their cameras, where they wanted to be, like what they wanted to be in the shot. And Representative Duco was like, you know what? The zebra is going with me. Like, this is going to be my
this is me
for session.
I'm
going to
make my mark.
Yep. Yeah. And I just think it's so cool and I love it.
Well, this is good, guys. Thank you for putting this slideshow together, because all I've gotten to see is the interiors of your homes so far, and this has broadened my perspective into what some of our state lawmakers do with their decorating choices.
Yeah, we now know what's possible. Mostly, I'm just trying to keep it away from my pile of dirty dishes or the laundry that I've let stack up. But maybe I need to put some more thought into my backdrop.
Just put a zebra print up there next to the dirty dishes and laundry, and you'll be fine.
Okay, yeah, I'll work on it.
Well, Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief.
Laurel White is WPR's Capitol Reporter.
And John K. Wilson is our resident politics nerd.
When it comes to the WBR Politics podcast, at least, it turns out that the new normal is a lot like the old one, because you can get new episodes of the show delivered to you almost every single week when you subscribe. You can do that on Apple Podcasts, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, and many other podcast apps. And while you're there, leave a rating or review of the show to help other people find it. And of course, you can catch up on all of our past episodes anytime by going to wpr.org/politics.